Assalamu alaikum. Almost all of us have been faced with the questioning of a child. By repeating one word over and over, he can be very frustrating to us as he asks, why? If you put a knife up out of his reach, he wants to know why. When you explain it sharp, why? And so you explain in order to cut fruit, and he says, why? And so it goes. It illustrates the dilemma of applying reason. What we have to do when we apply reason is first set the standards of proof. We decide for ourselves, what will I be satisfied with? If I find such and such and so, that constitutes for me a final proof. We have to decide that first. What happens, though, is that on the really important issues, the philosophical matters, thinkers set standards of proof, and then they take a look at their subject, and eventually they may arrive at their standards. They may arrive at the point which they said would constitute a proof. But then they ask for a proof of the proof. The key to avoiding this endless dissatisfaction is to satisfy ourselves about standards first. To satisfy ourselves that such and such a list of criteria constitute proof, satisfying proof. And then we test the subjects that we examine. In particular, I will apply this to the Quran. Now, ask a thoughtful Christian why he is a Christian, and he will usually reply, the miracle of the resurrection. The basis for his belief being that about 2,000 years ago, a man died and he was raised from the dead. That is his miracle, his touchstone, because all else depends on that. Ask a Muslim, well, what is your miracle? Why are you a Muslim? Where is your miracle? And the Muslim can go over and take his miracle off the shelf and hand it to you, because his miracle is still with us today. It is the Quran. It is his touchstone. While all the prophets had their signs, Moses had the competition with the magicians of Pharaoh, Jesus healed the sick, raised the dead, and so on. All prophets had their signs. The one sign given to the last of the prophets, according to the Muslims, is the book, the Quran. And this one sign is still with us. And doesn't that, after all, seem fair? That if prophethood is to end, that the last prophet should bring something that stays with us. So that today, in fact, a Muslim who takes his religion seriously suffers no disadvantage to Muslims who lived 14 centuries ago. Those people who kept company with the prophet had access to no more information, no more of the necessary vital information we must have, than we have today. They had the Quran. That was assigned to them. It is still assigned to us today, the same miracle. Well, let's test the Quran. Suppose that I say to a man, I know your father. Probably he is going to examine the situation and see, does it seem likely that he meet my father? And if he's not convinced, he'll start asking me questions like, you know my father, you say, is he a tall man? Does he have curly hair? Does he wear glasses? And so on. He asks questions. If I keep giving him the right answer to all these questions, pretty soon he's going to be convinced, well, I guess this man did meet my father, like he said. You see the method. Now, here in the Quran, we have a book which claims that its author is one who was present at the beginning of the universe, at the beginning of life. So we have a right to address that author and say, well, tell me something. Prove it to me. Prove to me that you were there when the world began, when life began. In the 21st surah and the 30th ayah, that is the 21st chapter of the Quran, the 30th verse, we have an interesting statement. It reads, have not the disbelievers seen that the heavens and the earth were one piece, and we parted them? And we made every living thing from water. will they not then believe? There are three key points here. First of all, it is disbelievers who are mentioned as being those who would see that the heavens and the earth were one piece and then parted, and would see that all life came to be made from water. As it happens, the universally accepted origin of the universe is now the Big Bang theory, which maintains that at one time all of the heavens and the earth were one piece, the monoblock, it's called. And at a particular point in time, this was burst and continues to expand, and this gives us the universe we have today. This was a recent discovery, a recent confirmation. The Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded only a few years ago for those who confirmed the Big Bang origin of the universe. It was only about 200 years ago that Leeuwenhoek and others perfected the microscope and discovered for the first time that living cells are composed of about 80% water. Now, those Nobel Prize winners and the Dutchman who invented the microscope were not Muslims, and yet they confirmed the vital statement that at one time the universe was one piece, that life is made from water, just as this ayah says. Have not the disbelievers seen that the heavens and the earth were one piece, and we parted them, and we made every living thing from water? Will they not then believe? Well, this sounds like an answer to the question we started with when we asked of the author, tell me something that shows me you were present when the universe began, when life began. Now, everyone must be committed to something. You have to put your foot down someplace. It is impossible to be neutral at all times. There has to be a point of reference in the life of any thinking individual. You have to take a stand somewhere. The question, of course, is to put your foot down in the right place. Now, since there is no such thing as a proof of a proof of a proof, and so on, in order to find the right place to put one's foot down, to take a stand, we have to search and find that place. And it's by a method that I hope to illustrate in this talk. It's a question of finding a point of convergence. You see, we search for truth in many places, and we begin to know that we're succeeding in finding the truth if all our different paths start to converge. They start to come together to the same point. If we are examining a book looking for evidence of divine origin and we are led to Islam, this is one path. If at the same time we are examining the words of all those who were called prophets and we find ourselves led to Islam, we have a firmly grounded basis for belief. We started looking for truth in two different places and found ourselves going down a path headed for the same destination. No one ever proves all things. We have to stop at some point being satisfied with our standards, as I mentioned earlier. But the point is, in order to take a stand and to be sure it's in the right place, we want to examine all the evidence around us and see where does it lead us, and anticipate this point of convergence. To say it looks like all things are pointing to this place. We go to that place and then look at all the data around us to see if it fits into place. Does it now make sense? Are we standing in the right place? Let me first show more of our examination of the Quran, and then an examination of some words of prophets to find this point of convergence. In the 51st surah and the 47th ayah, it is mentioned that the firmament, the heavens, are expanding. As I mentioned earlier, this is in connection with the Big Bang origin of the universe, as it's usually called. It was in 1973 that the Nobel Prize was awarded to three men for confirming that, after all, the universe is expanding. In this ayah of the Quran, it's very clear, in speaking of the heavens doing exactly that. For Muslims who, over the centuries, studied the Quran, their comments on this verse are very interesting. The wisest among them have stated that the words are very clear, the heavens are expanding, but they couldn't imagine how that could be so, but they were content to leave the words as they were, to say, Allah knows best. In the 89th surah, a city is mentioned by the name of Iram in the 7th ayah. The city of Iram has been unknown to history, so unknown, in fact, that even some Muslim commentators, out of embarrassment or feeling apologetic for their religion, have commented on this mention of the city in the Quran as being perhaps figurative, that Iram was possibly a man and not a city. Well, in 1973, the excavations in Syria at the site of the ancient city of Eblis uncovered the largest collection of cuneiform writing on clay tablets ever assembled. In fact, the library discovered at Eblis contains more clay tablets that are more than 4,000 years old than all the other tablets combined from all other sites. And interestingly enough, you'll find the details in the National Geographic of 1978, I believe it is, which confirm that in those tablets, the city of Iram is mentioned. The people of Eblis used to do business with the people of Iram. So here, in 1973, comes confirmation of the fact that, after all, there really was an ancient city by that name, wherever it was. How did it find its way into the Quran, we might ask. Those Muslims who may have offered their comments trying to explain away this reference that they were uncomfortable with were outsmarted by the author of the Quran. There are those who would outsmart the author of the Quran. They would attempt it. Primarily, their activity involves trying to produce the evidence that the author of this book had a primitive understanding of the world around us. For example, there is a word which is translated today, usually, in Arabic as atom, dharra. This is usually translated atom, and it is usually thought of in Arabic as being the smallest item available. At one time, perhaps the Arabs thought this was an ant or a grain of dust. Today, the word is usually translated atom. Well, those who would outsmart the author of the Quran have insisted that, well, the atom is not, after all, the smallest piece of matter, because in this century it has been discovered that even the atom is made up of still smaller pieces of matter. Is it then possible to outsmart the author who chose to use this word? Well, there's an interesting verse in the 10th surah, the 61st ayah, which speaks of items the size of a dharra, an atom, or smaller. As a matter of fact, because of this particular statement, there is no possibility that on this subject someone is going to say a new discovery has outdated the words of the Quran on the issue of the size of matter or the ultimate particles. The ayah talks about items the size of a dharra, an atom, or smaller. Now, speaking of outsmarting the author of the Quran, the Islamic point of view is that when a man embraces Islam, his past is forgiven from the very beginning. This has been the attitude, the invitation to Islam. Come to Islam, and all is forgiven from the past. But consider this. There is only one enemy of Muhammad, alayhi salam, who is mentioned by name in the Quran, one Abu Lahab. And in a short surah of this book, he is condemned to punishment for his sins. As it happens, the man himself was alive for many years after this revelation. He could, therefore, have finished Islam very easily. He needed only to go to the Muslims to announce his conversion. They had in their hands a revelation which said, no, this man is doomed to punishment. He could go to the Muslims and say, I accept Islam. Am I forgiven or not? And he could have confused them so much as to finish this small movement, because he would have been pointing out to them that they were now in confusion. Their policy was instant forgiveness of the past, but their own revealed scripture announced that he was not forgiven. In fact, the Quran confidently predicted a number of things only a few years before they came to pass. The fall of the Persian Empire, for example, was predicted, in spite of the fact that it had just suffered a serious military reverse. The evidence was all to the contrary. But in the surah entitled Rome, or Arum, the fall of the Persian Empire, who were only recently victors over the Romans, was predicted. When all the Muslims in the world could meet in one room, the revelations were already discussing their future successes. In confidence, they were planning for the day when they would be in charge of the city where they were forced at that time to hide for their very lives. Now, some people may like to find any number of things in the Quran, but an honest method in examining this book, looking for evidence of divine origin, is to take things at their value, to look where things are clear, and to look in those places where we are invited to look. Remember the passage that I quoted earlier, "Have not the disbelievers seen?" Time and again, this is the phrasing of the Quran, saying, "O man, have you not seen?" The invitation is to examine the evidence. And in these places, we are doing the sensible thing if we examine the words used to look for the depth of meaning and to find evidence of divine origin. Now, each one of us is an expert on something. One doesn't have to have a degree in a particular subject to decide that now I can take my expertise to the Quran and see what I can find. We all know something for sure from our own experience in life. We heard the story several years ago in Toronto of a man who was given the Quran to read. The man was a member of the Merchant Marine, so he spent his life on the sea. When he read the 40th ayah of the 24th surah and its description of waves on the ocean, waves within waves and the darkness between, he was very surprised because the description was just as he knew the situation to be. When he returned the book, the Quran, to the man who gave it to him to read, he asked him, because he was completely ignorant of the origins of Islam, he asked him, "This Muhammad, was he a sailor?" Well, of course, he was quite surprised to know that the man spent his life in the desert. And so he had to ask himself, from where did he get this knowledge of what it looks like on a stormy sea? We all know something that we can be confident of. And if we can turn to the Quran to see what does it say on the subject, we're asking for confirmation of our belief in the divine origin of the book. A friend of mine at the University of Toronto had the experience of dealing with a man who was doing PhD work for his psychology degree. He chose as his subject the efficiency of group discussion. He suggested a number of criteria as to what constitutes an efficient discussion. He graphed the process, that is, he achieved a measure of the efficiency of all groups in their discussions according to an index by his system. And on his graph, he indicated the progress made by discussion groups of various sizes from, I believe it was 12 on down. The interesting thing that happened, which he didn't expect to find when he began his project, was that while there was some difference between the size of any given group and how well they did in discussion, did they get matters settled, did people change their minds, did new information come to light, and so on, he was surprised to find that groups of two were completely off his scale. In other words, when two people sat down to discuss something, they were so much more efficient than any other size of group that it went completely off his scale of measurement. Well, when my friend heard about this and was discussing it with a man concerned, something went on in the back of his mind. My friend, being a Muslim, thought there's something familiar here about this idea. The psychology researcher was not a Muslim. He was debating with himself on changing the topic of his thesis. Should he call it the phenomenon of two, or the two phenomenon? He was so surprised at his discovery. Meanwhile, my friend found that in the Quran, there is an ayah, and he found it for himself the same night. There is an ayah which speaks on discussions and the size of groups and how efficient they are. And maybe we shouldn't be surprised to find that it is the groups that are two in number that do the best in achieving results. The ayah of the Quran reads concerning discussion groups that when discussing the Quran, one should sit alone and reflect on its meaning or discuss it in groups of two. Now for myself, as I said, everyone knows something for sure or has an interest, an experience in life. My interest is mathematics and logic. There is an ayah of the Quran, it begins the 11th surah, which says, "This is a scripture whose verses are perfected and then expounded," which tells me that there are no wasted words in the Quran, that the verses, each verse is perfected and then it is explained. It couldn't be in a better form. One could not use less words to say the same thing. Or if one used more words, one would only be adding superfluous information. So this directed my attention to a particular mathematical subject, a logical subject, and I examined the Quran to see if I would find something of what I knew to be the case. A revolution in logic has occurred in the last 100 years, primarily over the difference between use and mention of words. The structure of logic seemed to be in danger of collapsing about 100 years ago because it came to the attention of the people who study these matters that the structure was not quite sound. The issue involved, in particular, self-reference and the use and mention of words, which I'll explain just briefly. Aristotle's law of the excluded middle was the statement that every statement is either true or false. About 100 years ago, somebody pointed out that that law is a statement. Therefore, if we apply the statement to itself, the law of the excluded middle is not a law after all. It could just as well be false as well as true. This was a tangled knot for the logicians to untie until they came to understand the difference between the use and the mention of a word. When we use a word, we consider its meaning. When we mention a word, we are discussing the word itself. If I say Toronto is a large city, I mean Toronto, that place, is a large city. If I say Toronto has seven letters, I'm talking about the word Toronto. In the first case, I used the word. In the second, I mentioned the word. You see the distinction. Now, connecting these ideas and the idea that the Quran is composed of verses that are perfected and then expounded for us, consider the ayah which says, "The likeness of Jesus before Allah is as the likeness of Adam." In Arabic, it's very clear that what we have in this statement is an equation. It reads, "Inna mathal Isa inda Allahi kamathal Adam." The likeness of Isa is as the likeness of Adam. Now, of course, the verse goes on to explain how that's true, because they both came to be under unusual circumstances, rather than having a mother and a father in the usual human reproductive way. But more than that, I got to considering the use and the mention of words. The words are used clearly enough. Jesus is like Adam, and by Jesus and Adam we mean those two men. But what about the mention of the words? Was the author aware of the fact that if we're considering the words as words in themselves, this sentence also reads that Jesus is somehow like Adam? Well, they're not spelled with the same letters. How can they be alike in this revelation? Well, the answer came to me fairly quickly, and I took a look at the index of the Quran. The index of the Quran has been available only since 1945. This book was the result of years of work by a man and his students who assembled a book which lists every word in the Quran and where it can be found. So when we look up the word Isa, Jesus, we find it in the Quran 25 times. When we look up Adam, we find it is in the Quran 25 times. The point is they're very much alike in this book, those two symbols. Just as the word or the verse reads, they are equated. So following up on this idea, I then continued to examine the index, looking for every case where something was set up as an equation, where the likeness of something was said to be as the likeness of another thing. And in every case, it works. You have, for example, in the 7th surah, the 176th ayah, it says, the likeness of those who reject our signs is as the likeness of the dog. Well, the phrase in Arabic, the people who reject our signs, will be found in the Quran exactly 5 times. And so is the Arabic word al-kalb, the dog, 5 times. And there are several instances of exactly the same occurrence. It was some months after I found this for myself that a friend of mine, who was continuing the investigation with me, made the suggestion that there are also some places in the Quran where one thing is said to be not like another thing. Well, as soon as he mentioned the thought to me, we both went for the index and had a quick look at several places where one thing is said to be not like another thing and counted their occurrence in the Quran. We were surprised, and maybe shouldn't have been, to find that, after all, they don't match up, but an interesting thing does happen. In the case, for example, as the Quran makes it very clear in an ayah that trade is not like interest, the two words will be found 6 times for one, 7 for another. And so it is in every other case. Where one thing is said to be like another, or not like another, they occur with a difference of 1 time. It will be 5 of one, 4 of the other, or 7 of one and 8 of another. There is one interesting verse which I felt spoke directly to me from right off the page. It's in the 5th surah, the 100th ayah, which mentions two words in Arabic, al-khabith, the evil, and at-tayyib, the good. The verse reads, say, the evil and the good are not comparable, even though the abundance of evil will surprise you. So be mindful of your duty to Allah, O man of understanding, that you may succeed. Well, I had a look at those two words in Arabic, the evil and the good, and found that in the Quran they both occur 7 times. Yet the verse here is saying that they're not comparable. I shouldn't expect to find that they occur the same number of times. But what does the rest of this ayah say? The evil and the good are not comparable. The abundance of the evil will surprise you, and it did, and there were too many of them. But it continues, so be mindful of your duty to Allah, O men of understanding, that you may succeed. So press on, use your understanding, and you'll succeed, is what the verse said to me. Well, in the 8th surah, I found the answer, the 37th ayah, where it reads, Allah separates the evil from the good. The evil he piles one on top of the other, heaping them all together. So here is the solution to the difficulty. While we have 7 occurrences of al-khabith, which matches up with the occurrences of the good, according to the principle in this ayah, evil is separated from good and then piled one on top of the other and heaped all together. We don't count them as 7 separate instances. A favorite difficulty, or supposed difficulty, which critics like to cite or have cited in past years concerning the Quran, is that apparently, to their way of thinking, the author of this book was ignorant because he advised the Muslims to follow the lunar year instead of the solar year. And the critics say, well, the author was unaware of the difference in the length of years, that if one follows 12 lunar months, one loses 11 days every year. The author of the Quran was well aware of the distinction between the length of the solar year and the lunar year. In the 18th surah, the 9th ayah, it mentions 300 years and gives their equivalent as 309 years. As it happens, 300 solar years is equal to 309 lunar years. But let's go back to my original scheme of the occurrence of words in the Quran. The word month in the Quran, shahr, will be found 12 times in the Quran, 12 times according to the index. There are 12 months in this book. If we find 12 months, how many days should we expect to find? The word in Arabic is yawm. And as it happens, you can look for yourself with a copy of the index. You will find there are 365 days in the Quran. As a matter of fact, the original issue which had me interested in looking up the occurrence of months and days was this distinction between the solar year and the lunar year. Well, for about 25 centuries, it has been known that the relative positions of the sun, moon, and earth coincide every 19 years. This was discovered by a Greek by the name of Meton and is called the Metonic cycle. Knowing this, I looked again to the index for the word year, Sena, and found, sure enough, it occurs in the Quran 19 times. Now, what is the point of this perfect balance of words? For myself, it shows the author was well aware of the distinction between using words and mentioning words, a fine logical point. But more than that, it indicates the preservation of this book. After giving a lecture on the subject of the Quran, I touched on some of these subjects, and a questioner from the audience afterwards said, "How do we know we still have the original Quran? Maybe pieces of it have been lost, or extra parts have been added." Well, I pointed out to him that we had pretty well covered that point, because since these items, the perfect balance of words in the Quran, has come to light only in this generation, anybody who would have lost a portion of the book, hidden some of it, or added some of their own, would have been unaware of this carefully hidden code in the book. They would have destroyed this perfect balance. It's interesting to note, too, that while such a thing might be possible to organize today by the use of a computer to coordinate all words so that whatever thought you might have as to the meaning of a sentence, however you might construe an equation out of a sentence, you could check for yourself and the book would always have the balance of words. If that were possible today, if it were possible 14 centuries ago, why would it be done and then left hidden and never drawn to the attention of those who first saw this book? Why would it be left with the hope of the author who contrived this, that maybe in many centuries someone will discover it and have a nice surprise? It's a scheme that doesn't make sense. In the 25th surah and the 33rd ayah, we are told that no questioner will come to the Muslims with a question for which a good answer has not been provided, and the best explanation for whatever his question. That's Surah 25, Ayah 33. Well, what is it really saying? This ayah has said, for everything they say, we are given something to go back to them and reply. We look again to the index of the Quran, and we find that the word they say, in Arabic, kalu, is found 332 times. Now, what would be the natural counterpart but the Arabic word kul, which is the command, say? And you will find in the index it occurs 332 times also. In fact, an interesting feature of the Quran is that it replies to its critics as to its origins. That is, no one has yet come up with a suggestion as to where this book came from, which is not commented on within the book itself. In fact, the New Catholic Encyclopedia, under the heading Quran, mentions that over the centuries there have been many theories as to where this book came from. Their conclusion? Today, no sensible person believes any of these theories. This leaves the Christian in some difficulty, in their own words. You see, all the theories suggested so far, according to this encyclopedia, are really not acceptable to anyone sensible today. They're too fantastic. And yes, the Christian is left in some difficulty. Where did the book come from? Those who have not really examined the Quran usually dismiss it as being, as they say, a collection of proverbs or aphorisms, sayings that one man used to announce from time to time. They imagine that there was a man who from time to time during the day would think of some witty little saying and spit it out, and those around him would quickly write it down, and eventually this was all collected and became the Quran. Well, those who read the Quran find out that it's not anything like that at all. the collection of things said by the Prophet is the subject and the content of Hadith. But the subject, the contents of the Quran, are all in the form of a composition, an explanation. I cite, for example, the Surah Yusuf, which is an entire story in great detail about one particular episode or one portion of the life of one man. It is a composition. It is for this reason that virtually all those who have actually examined the Quran usually refer to it as being the product of the authorship is attributed to Muhammad and his coadjutors, in their words. His coadjutors. That means those who used to sit with him and compose the Quran. You see, they imagine that the Quran was composed by a committee. They acknowledge that there's too much information and it's too well composed for one man to have assembled. So they imagine that a committee of men used to meet regularly, bring their various sources of information, compose something, then hand it to this man and tell him, go to the people tomorrow, this is your revelation. In other words, it was a fraud concocted by a group of people. But what do we know about fraud? The Quran reminds us in the 34th surah, 49th ayah, as it says, say, now the truth has come, and falsehood neither invents anything nor restores anything. In fact, it's hard to translate into English precisely, but what this ayah is telling us is that falsehood is not the source of a new thing. A new and truthful thing cannot come from falsehood, and falsehood does not restore to our minds the facts. Truth is agreement with facts. Falsehood is something else. So falsehood is empty. If something is born in fraud, it will never bring us new information. It will never endure. It will only collapse over a period of time. Another interesting ayah is a challenge in the 4th surah, the 82nd ayah, which is addressed to those non-believers. It reads, have they not considered the Quran? If it came from other than Allah, surely they would find in it many inconsistencies. You see, here is a challenge to the reader. If you think you have an explanation for where this book came from, have another look at the book. Surely you'll be able to uncover some inconsistencies to support your case. Imagine a student submitting a term paper or a final exam, and then writing at the bottom of the page a note to his teacher, you'll find no mistakes in this paper. There are no mistakes on this exam. Can you imagine the teacher letting that rest? The teacher would probably not sleep until uncovering some inconsistency after a challenge like that. That's not the way human beings speak. They don't offer challenges like that. But here we have it in the Quran, a direct challenge saying, if you have a better idea as to where this book came from, here's all you need to do. Find some inconsistencies. Now, there are critics who make the attempt, critics who try to say the Quran contains inconsistencies. A publication that came to my attention recently suggested that the Quran was contradictory on the subject of marriage, because in one place it says, don't marry more than one wife unless you can provide for them all, and in another place it said, don't marry more than four. Now, this they see as a contradiction. What they have is a contradistinction. In the one case, the qualification for marrying more than one has been given. In the other case, limitation on how many that may be married is given. There is no contradiction. Critics are too quick to grab hold of something and give it an interpretation and offer it as an excuse to escape the reality of this document. For critics who would attack the Quran and insist that it contains mistakes, we can use the same method as in our reply to Christians who claim that Jesus is on record as claiming to be equal to God. Remember the three categories of evidence offered. The evidence offered was either insufficient, ambiguous, or impossible. You see, if someone cites a verse from the Quran trying to show that it is a mistake, we only need to show that the verse cited is insufficient to establish that there is a mistake, or we need to show that the verse cited
has other meanings than the one given by the critic, or we can demonstrate that the verse cited cannot possibly have the interpretation which the critic is giving it. It will always fall into one of these three categories. I had the experience on one occasion of describing some of the contents of the Quran to a man who didn't know what the book was I was talking about. It sat next to me with the cover turned over. I just told him about the book, what it contained, told him it was not the Bible. His conclusion was that the book was miraculous. This man was a minister in a Christian church. He said, yes, that book could not possibly have originated with a man. Therefore, it must have come from the devil, because it is not the Bible. Well, the Quran comments on this suggestion, the 26th surah, 211th ayah, as to those who would suggest that the book came from the devil. It points out that it doesn't quite suit him, does it? Is this how the devil misleads people? He tells them, worship none but God. He insists that they fast, that they practice charity. Is this how the devil misleads people? Compare the attitude of someone like this to the attitude of the Jews who knew Jesus and opposed him until the very end. There is an episode reported in the Bible where Jesus raised a man from the dead, one Lazarus, who had been dead for 4 days. When Lazarus came out of the tomb alive again, those Jews who were watching, what did they do? Did they suddenly say, this man is a true prophet, and become believers? No, the Bible says, they immediately discussed among themselves that since this man is working all these signs, soon everyone will believe in him, we've got to find a way to kill him. And they attributed his miraculous powers to the devil. He raised that man by the power of the devil. Now the Christian reads that episode and feels very sorry for those Jews who had clear evidence right before their very eyes and attributed the miracles, the signs, to the devil. Doesn't it appear that they may be doing the same thing when we illustrate what we have in the Quran and their final excuse is only, it originated with the devil? There are those who will insist that the Quran was copied, that it originated in Christian and Jewish sources. As a matter of fact, a book published in recent years called Worshipping the Wrong God has stated, as though it were a fact, that after the first revelation of the Quran came to Muhammad, alayhi salam, that his wife died, and so he quickly married a Jew and a Christian, and this is where he drew the rest of his sources for his book. Well, they have the facts partly right. It was 10 years after the first revelation of the Quran that his wife died. And it was another 10 years after that, when the Quran was virtually complete, that he married a Jew and a Christian. Did he copy from Jewish and Christian sources? In the Quran, the ruler of Egypt who opposed Moses is known as Firaun, not Pharaoh. The Jews and Christians have always said Pharaoh. It's easy for an Arab to say Pharaoh, but in the Quran it's Firaun with an N. Why? Surely the Jews and Christians who surrounded the Muslim community must have teased them about that and said, you've got the word wrong. It's Pharaoh, not Firaun. But they insisted on it, and it continues that way in the Quran, Firaun. As it happens, the historical writings of Herodotus, the ancient Greek historian, exist to this day. And Herodotus comments on the ruler of Egypt being, in his day and in the centuries before him, one man who went by the title of Firaun. Did the book copy from Christian sources where in the fourth surah it insists that Jesus was not crucified, that this was only an illusion, or that the Jews who thought they crucified Jesus were mistaken because it wasn't really so? Christians would have no part of that. As it happens, the idea that Jesus was not really crucified is really very ancient and can be traced back to the first century. But Christians who believed that were eliminated as heretics within the first 200 years after the time of Jesus. And they weren't teaching this doctrine anywhere around the Arabian Peninsula 14 centuries ago. Could the author of the Quran have been copying from Christian sources when he says in the third surah, the 46th ayah, speaking of Jesus,
that he spoke to men as a babe and in later life. And the Arabic word used indicates that he still was speaking to men and teaching to them in his 40s. The Christians have always maintained that Jesus was gone by the time he was 33. It indicates there could have been no copying. In fact, a man would have to be stubborn and insist on the points as explained in the Quran in the face of Christian opposition, who would have said, no, it wasn't like that. We tell the story differently. Now to the words of prophets themselves, another path that leads to Islam. In the Persian scriptures, which have been around for thousands of years, we find long before the time of Islam and its arrival in the Arabian Peninsula, in the Farsi scriptures, Dasatir number 14, we read, "When the Persians should sink so low in morality, a man will be born in Arabia, whose followers will upset their throne, religion, and everything. The mighty, stiff-necked ones of Persia will be overpowered. The house which was built and in which many idols have been placed will be purged of idols, and people will say their prayers facing towards it. His followers will capture the towns of the Farsis and Taus and Balkh and other big places round about. People will embroil with one another. The wise men of Persia and others will join his followers." Muslims recognize this very quickly because the Kaaba, the building which all Muslims face in prayer every day, was at one time filled with idols, and it was part of the mission of Muhammad, alayhi salam, to purge the house of idols. They were cleansed, and that house sits there empty still today. It was in the next generation, after the time of the Prophet, that the wise men of Persia and others did join his followers. In the Bible, in Deuteronomy chapter 18, we have the words of Moses, who reports that God told him that he would raise up a prophet from among the brothers of the Israelites like Moses. Now Christians wish to apply this to Jesus, to say he was the prophet like Moses. It's uncomfortable for them to recognize, however, that Jesus was not very much like Moses. Now Jesus had no father, no wife, no children, he didn't die of old age, and he didn't lead a nation. All of these things Moses had or did. But they say, well, Jesus will return. He'll return as a victorious person, and so he'll be more like Moses. Do they really expect he will return to also acquire a father and a wife and children and then die of old age? Not usually. Moreover, Jesus was an Israelite. The passage of Scripture says that this prophet that was foretold would be raised up from among the brothers of the Israelites, not from the Israelites. In the third chapter of Acts, the disciple Peter speaks to a crowd of people and explains that Jesus has been taken up, and he's in heaven, he says. And he says he will remain in heaven. He cannot return until all the things that were promised by God come to pass. So what are we still waiting for, does he tell the crowd? He quotes this very saying of Moses, saying, "For God will raise up a prophet from among the brothers of the Israelites, like Moses," and so on. The point is very clear. Christians like to see this prophet as being Jesus. But read carefully Acts chapter 3. What it says is that Jesus awaits a return. He cannot return until the fulfillment of this prophecy, that another prophet has to come. Jesus spoke of it himself, and the words survive, just barely, but they survive in the Bible. Jesus spoke of God sending another paraclete. Now there's a lot of argument over the meaning of this word paraclete. For now we can leave that aside. What is a paraclete? It doesn't matter. The first letter of John shows that Jesus was a paraclete. He's called a paraclete. And we have Jesus promising another paraclete is going to be sent. Now, in English, we lose a lot by this word, another, because it's ambiguous. If someone's car breaks down, and it's a Toyota, and I say, "I'll go and get you another car," maybe I mean, "I'll go and get you another Toyota, because this one you have is broken." Or maybe I mean, "Forget Toyotas, they're no good, I'll go and get you another car, I'll get you a Datsun." It's ambiguous, the word another in English. But the Greeks had a word for it. When they meant another of the same kind, they said allos. When they meant another of a different kind, they said heteros. And the important thing here is that when Jesus, who was himself a paraclete, said, God will send you another paraclete, he used the word allos, not heteros. Christians want to say that this other paraclete that was being sent was different than Jesus. It wasn't a man, it was a spirit. What Jesus said was, God will send you another paraclete, allos, another one, like me, another man. This is not uniquely a Muslim interpretation. Rudolf Bultmann, in his 1971 book, The Gospel of John, a commentary, said, the paraclete is therefore a parallel figure to Jesus himself. It is clear from this reference of John 14 and 16 that the source taught that there were two sendings of two paracletes, Jesus and his successor, the one following the other. And Muslims believe, of course, that Muhammad is the fulfillment of this prophecy by Jesus. The Quran says that this man is mentioned in the scriptures of the Jews and the Christians. Find this in the 7th surah, 157th ayah. Christians came to expect the return of Jesus because of a Jewish misunderstanding. Messiah and Son of Man had been given special significance by the Jews, even though many people were called by these same names within the Bible. The Jews came to expect a victorious leader. When Jesus didn't turn out to be quite what many expected, they hatched the idea that he would return someday and fulfill all these prophecies. Well, suppose that someone observed Jesus 2,000 years ago, and then he left this planet, or he went to sleep for 2,000 years, and returned today to look for the followers of Jesus. Who would he find? Who would he recognize? Christians? I conclude with just this food for thought. The Bible says very clearly that Jesus used to fast. Do Christians fast? Muslims fast. It's obligatory 1 month of every year. The Bible says that Jesus prayed by touching his forehead to the ground. Do Christians pray in this manner? Muslims do. It's characteristic of their prayer, and no one on earth is probably ignorant of that fact. According to Jesus, he told his disciples to greet one another with the expression, peace be with you. Do Christians do that? Muslims do, universally. Whether they speak Arabic or not, the greeting one to another is, salam alaikum, peace be with you. The brother of Jesus, in the book of James, stated that no man should suggest what he is about to do or highlight his plans for the next few days in any way without adding the phrase, if God wills. Do not say, I will go here and there and do this and that, without adding the phrase, if God wills. Do Christians do that? Muslims do, whether they speak Arabic or not. If they so much as suggest that they're going downtown to pick up some groceries, they'll add, Insha'Allah, which in Arabic means, if God wills. Those conclude my thoughts on this subject. May Allah guide us always closer to the truth.